Hi, I'm Larkin Swain. Welcome to Sanctuary, an ongoing conversation for seekers like me who want to dive deep into the meaning and power of the temple. These are expansive, transparent, and sometimes challenging conversations with thoughtful and wise people about the history, the symbols, the rituals, and the experiences that make up temple worship. I have a lot of questions. Maybe you do too. Welcome to the journey. Hi everyone, this is Larkin from Sanctuary. I'm super excited to be sharing this conversation with you that I had with Jared Lambert. Jared is such a fascinating person. Let me tell you a little bit about him. He is a historical linguist specializing in the ancient Near East and the Hebrew Bible. He's a former military linguist in the United States Army and previously served as the lead linguist over sacred materials for The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, working directly with temple-related content. Jared holds multiple degrees across linguistics, history, and religious studies, and is currently completing his PhD in historical linguistics. His work focuses on diachronic language development, temple theology, and the ways translation, symbolism, and later theological frameworks reshaped earlier biblical traditions, particularly surrounding covenant, priesthood, and the divine feminine. So cool. He teaches courses on biblical language and symbolism and creates content aimed at helping modern readers approach scripture with greater historical and linguistic clarity. For this episode, we sat down and I got to hear Jared's presentation on the creation story, which was so interesting and feels perfectly timed as we're just beginning the Old Testament in Come Follow Me, which opens with this account. Through a linguistic lens, Jared explores the ancient text's etymological roots, revealing deeper meanings that resonate with both scientific and spiritual perspectives. He shares powerful insights into Adam and Eve, the nature of God as understood by ancient Israelites, and how that very closely resembles the God worshipped by Latter-day Saints today. Most impactful to me was his reinterpretation of Eve and the essential role she played in humanity's story. This conversation was so interesting and left me eager to learn more. We only scratched the surface of Jared's work, and those interested can explore his classes where he guides students on a linguistic journey through the scriptures. You can find a sign-up link in the show notes if you're interested. And without further ado, here is the episode. I hope you enjoy it. Jared, welcome to Sanctuary. Thanks so much for coming down here and taking the time to have this conversation. Super stoked for it.
Yeah.
I know you have a lot prepared and I'm really, really excited to dive in. But before we do, let's just start with having you share your background, how you came to this point of being a historical linguist. Anything you want to share that brought you to this point to give people some context for where you're coming from?
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, thank you for having me. This is really fun. So who am I? I am Jared Lambert. I'm a historical linguist. What does that mean? I study, diachronic linguistics, which is the study of, you look at the oldest rendition or the etymological roots of a word, and then you trace that single word throughout history, in order to better, find the meaning and understand it or the morphology of that word over time. And you kind of trace that throughout time. So how did I come to do that? Honestly, I don't think anyone wakes up and is like, I want to be a historical linguist. Like nobody knows what that is. I fell into it and I really did. I grew up in the church here in Salt Lake City, Utah, ran off to Africa. And I served my mission on the islands of the islands of Cape Verde, which is West Africa.
Okay.
So these small islands off the coast of West Africa. Absolutely loved it there. The most incredible people in the world are there. Loved my experiences there and fell in love with language because there are a lot of different languages on those islands, a lot of proto languages and creoles. And so I fell in love with language and loved my mission so much. I stayed there. I bought a house on the island of Fogo and I would live and work going in between college studies and working in humanitarian aid. And then learned a lot of different languages and loved studying linguistics. And then I was recruited in the United States Army. So served as a military linguist there. And that was really interesting because then I just met a lot of different amazing people all different branches, who had a lot of different perspectives on faith and understanding of gospel. And it became very clear to me with my linguistic understanding that we're all speaking the same language. We're just not understanding what that language is. Mm-hmm. So it was a linguistic problem that I noticed. And it also gave me a lot more questions as to how to define that in the gospel. So I left the military with this goal, which is I'm going to study until I have answered my questions for what the gospel is and how to best linguistically lay that out for everyone. So that is a horrible idea. Most people go to college because they're like, I want to have this job. I want to do this. And I didn't do that, right? I went to school being like, I need to answer all these questions I have about the gospel. So hence, I have been going to school for 20 years. Wow. I'm still a student. I have 7 degrees. I speak 8 languages. And I don't think I'm ever going to be able to stop going to school. I have way too much debt. If I stop, I'm in trouble. So I will just go forever is the new plan. When I was working on my PhD, I was very focused on temple iconography of ancient texts and like the temple evolution, really focusing on the age of the first temple transitioning to the age of the second temple. I was studying that. I wrote a long paper on that, and I sent that to a few people, and they forwarded onto the church, which got my name into the church's system somehow. And so I got a random call one day, and they offered me a job as the linguist over sacred materials department of the church, I think is what it's called. And I would help implement the linguistic changes you're seeing in the temple today and the ones that are coming. And then I left, and it was awesome. I loved that experience. It was super cool. Enjoyed that and love everybody there. And then I left there, and I am now finishing my PhD in historical linguistics, just the study of diachronic linguistics on the scripture text, right? Ancient scripture. And yeah, so that's me in a nutshell. That's what I do. My main goal here is I try to show everybody, if you study the linguistics of the Bible, you get a completely different narrative of the Bible, because people don't get it. Like, the Bible is this traditional kind of group understanding of what has been interpreted as the gospel. And that has been influenced for geopolitical reasons, that have been influenced for just, you know, it's political reasons. It's a million different issues that we've seen projected onto this text that gives us the narrative that we have today. And so what I like to do for people is I like to take them through the scriptures, and I like to show them just how different the linguistics are from that traditional narrative that you've seen, because it really opens up a whole new world for you.
I would say what has been the most helpful in my study of the scriptures is like looking up words in Hebrew specifically when I get stuck on something and I push up against something, and it has opened up a whole new world for me and has deepened my testimony so much and helped. I feel like it's helped me to almost experience the message more instead of staying more in the cerebral space.
Yeah.
Like the deeper I've not that I've done much, but that I've delved into the etymology in some of these ancient Semitic languages, I feel like I'm starting to encounter more the experience of the message, if that makes sense, as it's expanded my understanding of it.
Oh, that's great. That's great. And I love to point out to everybody that you don't need to be a linguist. You don't need to go study. You don't need to go get the degrees I have or take on the debt that I have to be able to figure that out. There are so many resources that you can. And like you said, you can go to Bible Hub. You can go, you know, and dive into the Hebrew there. And there's been a lot of studies of that done, so that it makes it accessible to anyone to be able to do that. Now, there is a caveat that I love to point out to everybody, that you can't rely on that scholarship, because the issue we have with the Bible is that the Bible itself, especially the Old Testament, is written in, it's not Hebrew. I mean, that's the problem. We have Hebrew that we understand today versus the Hebrew that it was written in back then is a completely different language. And realistically, if you wanted to actually understand that the best, you would study more like Aramaic today, because it's more associated to that ancient proto-Hebrew that it was written in. And that proto-Hebrew, and the reason I emphasize that is because, and what I think you're honing in on, which is awesome that you're doing that, is that proto-Hebrew is what we call in linguistics a soft language versus our English language, which is a hard language. And what that means is hard languages are these kind of one-to-one ratio, rigid languages and meaning. So I say dog, it always means dog. It's not going to mean anything else. But see, these proto languages are conceptual and soft in the fact that they have so many different meanings. Like when you go to your Hebrew Bible and you look up this one word, you'll see there's seven or eight different definitions for that one word. And you have to ask yourself, okay, which definition applies? Because they're not always, you know, close to each other. But what you don't realize is those different definitions create a concept together. And that is how you're supposed to read your scriptures. It's in this concept of what it is. So it's much more fluid. We hate it as English speakers because we want that rigidity. We want that. We want to feel that it's grounded in this one definition. But you have to break out of that if you want to understand the language of God, because it's these soft languages that these concepts that are conveying the message, not in this rigidity of our modern understanding.
And I feel like that fluidity, again, draws us into the experience of the message, an embodied experience, which I feel I want so much more for us. We're really good at the cerebral, and like you're saying, we feel really comfortable in this rigidity and this singular understanding. But I just feel this continuous invitation to drop deeper into the experience of God and the message that's being conveyed to us, because I feel like that's where the real transformation happens.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Thank you for sharing. I know that you've prepared so much on specifically the creation story in the first, is it the first three chapters of Genesis that we're going to be exploring, which is super relevant to the temple experience as that's shared in the endowment ceremony. So, I'm excited to look at this with some fresh new eyes and extract some new greater understanding from it.
That's great. Yeah, no, I have a lot. So what I've done actually is I've developed like 27, 28 lessons, depending on how long they take, but that kind of help people understand the temple better, right? And it is surrounded around the temple. And what I do is I take people from the very beginning, I go through Genesis, and I walk them through the temple experiment of the old experience of the Old Testament. And then I bring them through the temple experience of the New Testament. And I bring them through our modern temples and the evolution that is in there to kind of show how this message of the temple has evolved over time and how God uses different narratives of the time. He really showcases different narratives that people understand, right? We know this. This is Doctrine and Covenants 1:24. He speaks to us according to our understanding. And so the way he showcases that is the temple narrative changes from dispensation to dispensation to dispensation and changes kind of venue or narrative, but the message is always the same. And it's those similarities that help us understand it the best. You know, the Adam and Eve narrative is not unique to the Hebraic nation. There are many. I mean, frankly, the creation narrative of the time that we have that predates the Hebraic interpretation, like the Gilgamesh epic or the Numa Elish, they tell the same story of this. In a garden is where everything begins, and here's Adam and here's Eve, or here are these two first humans, and the gods are here discussing over it. God just took that narrative that everybody understood at the time, and then he applied his own message to it. That's meant to teach us very specific lessons. And this is what God does. We see that same pattern that we have in our modern times, him doing the same thing. You see the evolution of the temple in our modern times, and you see how it evolved in that same way. God uses narratives of the time, and then he applies his message to it. And I know this is not what we're talking about, but I like talking about it. So I'm just going to diverge for a second. where, you know, when Joseph's trying to put in his revelation of the endowment into the temple, we see it evolve in different stages, right? His first stage of the Jackson plan was that he was going to have these 24 different buildings that would teach you all the different elements of the temple, because there is this polysemic level to it, which means poly, many, semic meanings. There's many meanings that you find in this text and you find in this narrative that it's hard to express, that it's hard to get that out there. So mm-hmm. Joseph had in Jackson the plan for 24 temples. When we got to Kirtland, he abandoned the 24 temples. They couldn't build one temple, let alone 24. Yeah. So he abandons that plan. In Kirtland, you notice he just has pews and then the main place. And so he wasn't planning on acting anything out. He wasn't planning on having different levels. In Kirtland, he was really hoping everyone would just share in his revelation. Mm-hmm. He was hoping we'd all receive that witness. And if you notice today, we're still told that. We're still told that you receive this by revelation. This is how it's supposed to be received. We go through the temple and we go through that experience to try to get us prepared to receive that revelation. Mm-hmm. But the end goal is always the same. Joseph wants you to have the vision of the endowment that he had, because otherwise it's ineffable. Otherwise you can't get every aspect of it. But then when you get to Nauvoo, Joseph takes a new tactic. And in this tactic, he borrows the ritual drama of Freemasonry, and he uses that as the vehicle to teach it, this form of LARPing, right? This mm-hmm. we're going to act this out. Mm-hmm. We're going to go through this narrative, and we're going to, so it's not that he steals the content of the Freemasons. They don't talk about any of the things. The meaning behind what we talk about is nothing like that. But he speaks to us according to our understanding. So he uses a narrative at the time that everybody understands, this ritual drama that is in Freemasonry at the time. And then he hijacks that. He takes that and teaches these incredible truths in it. This is really where our narrative starts. And you notice they do the same thing in the beginning in the Hebrew text. They steal this Enuma Elish doctrine, this notion of how the world began.
Yeah.
And they hijack that. They don't teach it the same way.
Yeah.
God's not evil. He's not trying to get you like they talk, you know, the mean gods punishing their children. They switch that narrative up
mm-hmm.
and they make it now about a loving God and the gods, the Elohim, which is the gods, right, who are trying to help their children. And then this is how this narrative builds out, right? Which is so interesting.
So fascinating. So this LARPing that you speak of, so how much of this creation story, this Adam and Eve in the garden, is literal versus a vehicle to convey the message?
That is because such a good question.
I think that a lot of us, I think the narrative is that we perceive the story as very literal. Mm-hmm. I think that's partly what makes it so confusing.
Yeah. Yeah.
But is it just the same situation as what Joseph did with the Freemasonry rituals? Is there was this great vehicle mm-hmm. made available to him that the people could understand through? And so that vehicle became what God mm-hmm. used to convey a much deeper message.
Yes.
That you can only understand through revelation. Is that what's happening with the creation story?
That is what's happening. That's what happens. Now, the problem is you're getting very pharisaical on me because you're like, where's the line?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
If you could answer that, geez, you'd be very, very wealthy, because the whole world would like to know that.
Yeah.
We can decipher quite a bit linguistically. I can show the parallels between the Enuma Elish and the Gilgamesh epic that show it. And it is marginal, right? You only have this much. Now all this is new content. We could do it that way.
Mm.
But in reality, I think that's the whole point. I use this word a lot and you're going to hear it a lot. It's this word polysemy, which is many meanings. And it's a very fluid concept, right? This conceptuality of God's language is polysemic. There's all these different meanings in that because you have to very fluidly take that, right? And you have to approach that in a very fluid narrative of, okay, I generally understand what the script is saying to me. Now, as you keep going, as you learn more and more about this gospel, slowly that conceptual language gets such incredible depth and it does become clear. You know, when we talk about these soft languages as being conceptual, it makes you think that it's fuzzy, that it's inefficient.
Mm.
It's not true. Mm. They were able to do everything that we were able to do, that we're able to do today. They're able to barter. They're able to get down to specifics. It just requires a little bit more to be able to define those things. So as you read the scriptures, as you come to know the gospel or Jesus Christ more, that message becomes clearer and clearer and clearer to you. But the problem is, your clarity and my clarity are always going to differ because my understanding, your understanding are always going to differ. There's always going to be date. Your interpretation is going to be different. My interpretation, who's right? Well, frankly, we're all wrong until we get that pure revelation, until we get that pure knowledge. So,
fascinating.
Sorry, that
I love that tangent.
I'm so sorry.
I love that tangent.
So if we go straight into the Genesis narrative, right, we can see this very different, like we have this traditional interpretation that's been passed down to us, right? Mm-hmm. And that traditional interpretation is awful. It has all these different influences on it. But most of all, it's telling us that women are dumb. Eve is bad, right? She made a mistake. She screwed up. And that Adam is incredible. And so right off the bat, if you believe in a just God and you believe in a God who's, you know, there's something wrong here. You can go, geez, just from a perspective of a woman, this doesn't feel right. And that's good because it's there. But more so, I believe in a God. I believe I'm a concordis. Okay? And what a concordis is somebody that believes that when God gives revelation, he gives it with absolute truth. He is revealing pure knowledge to his prophets. The problem we have is that the prophets are being accommodated because we as Latter-day Saints also believe in free agency. So we believe that this life is a test. We believe that you've come to this earth and you are going to be tested, not A, B, C, D, Scantron test, but rather pushed to your limit and tested and tried in your faith, meaning you're going through the fire, right? And so we believe that's the purpose of this life. And if God's greatest gift is this agency, he has to let us use that agency, right? And that results in a lot of big issues that we have, right? So when he reveals revelations of the prophet, it is pure knowledge, pure understanding, absolute truth. The problem is the prophet receives that knowledge according to his understanding at the time. Mm-hmm. And so what I like to show in the scriptures, like right from the beginning, is that we have a narrative that lines up very, very nicely with our understanding today, but you can also see how they're not understanding it back then. So for example, the traditional narrative we hear is that God created the earth ex nihilo, out of nothing. And it's this magical God theory, right? Where God is snapping his fingers and now there's the world and then here's man being made. But that's not what the linguistics tell us, right? Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heaven and earth. Okay, so that does sound like a magical God. He just created it from the beginning, right? But that's not what the linguistics say. The word here for beginning is bereshit. Bereshit, which is, it does mean the beginning, but it's not indicating in any way that this is the beginning of all things. This is more like, this is the beginning of our narrative, or once upon a time, or, you know, this is the word used to be able to set up the story. It is letting us know the beginning of this narrative, God created. Well, Jared, it says created. So that means God made it. So ex nihilo seems pretty corroborated here. But what is this word for created? Well, it's bara. Bara does not mean created. Snap my finger and now it's made. It is to form, to put together. Right? So if you're putting something together, what does that indicate? That indicates there is stuff there, right? And right from the get-go, we see Joseph when he gives us our version of this in the Pearl of Great Price. We see this notion of matter unorganized. It corroborates so perfectly with this that there's already things in existence that then come together. But then we also have this interesting notion of God at the beginning of this. Because what is God? Well, the Trinitarian perspective of God is that God is this one God. It's this kind of male blob God. And the problem with that is the word for God here is Elohim. So Elohim, everybody understands, is the name of God. But what does Elohim really mean? So what I love is Joseph hires a Hebrew Josiah Sextus to come and teach him Hebrew. And right from the get-go, they start in Genesis 1, and Joseph stops him right at the beginning and says, so the word there is not God. The word there is gods. It's plural. That's why it's Elohim. And he's right. It is plural. And Josiah Sextus says, no, I'm sorry. You're incorrect. Sure, it's plural, but it's kind of a royal we. Like, God is so royal. He's so amazing. He's speaking to himself in the third person. And this was the reply. And Joseph said, you know, I think you're wrong there. And it's because Joseph is doing the translation of the book of Abraham, and it makes it very clear. The gods went mm-hmm. down and said, here is matter organized. We will form together mm-hmm. a world, right? And so he's already on to this clue. And Joseph's exactly right, because if, first of all, the concept of a Trinitarian God doesn't exist in Hebrew. Like, they had no concept of it. That was invented at the ecumenical councils. So they're not writing about a Trinitarian God, right? This triune concept doesn't exist. What are they talking about? What is this Elohim that they're referring to? Well, Elohim's interesting because, etymologically speaking, the morphemes of the word Elohim themselves indicate that it's referencing more than one God, because it's comprised of different elements. Because if you wanted to make El, the male God, plural, you wouldn't say Elohim. The plural for El is Elam. So why, even if you're trying to indicate the royal we of God, as Josiah Sextus said, why did you say it that way? Why did you say Elohim? That makes no sense. Mm. Well, the Elohim is a much older tradition in the Hebraic faith. It is this council, right? We see this laid out again and again in the scriptures. Psalms talks about the Elohim, the council where God resides amongst the gods. Mm. And again, I love to point out to people is when they reference God there, it's still in the plural, separated from the lower gods. So this old Hebraic belief system is very similar to us in the fact that we are not monotheistic. We believe in a monolatrous system. What we